China's One Belt, One Road initiative, which of course covers much of the Asian region, is a huge opportunity for Australian business, but one being largely missed. That's the view of a co-author of a new report about infrastructure investment opportunities associated with the Belt and Road, as it's generally known. Mark Rathbone is a partner at PwC Singapore and PwC's Capital Projects and Infrastructure Asia Pacific leader. He's abreast of the details of this biggest infrastructure concept the world's ever seen. Beijing hopes its transnational infrastructure building program will spur growth in China's underdeveloped hinterland and Rust Belt. Mark Rathbone joins us now via Skype from Singapore. Welcome to Saturday Extra.
Thank you very much, Geraldine. Very nice to be a guest on your show. Thank you.
Now, Mark, before we even look at the opportunities you say are there, is it a problem that Australia hasn't signed the MOU on this project? New Zealand and Singapore, I noticed, were both quick to do so.
I think the first thing to recognise is that the MOU is not a binding document and doesn't create any obligations necessarily for any country to become involved. That said, of course, there is the symbolism around not signing it and whether or not that is seen to be something that the Australian government wants to address. But certainly countries like Singapore and New Zealand are looking to become more involved and more exposed to Belt and Road opportunities because it does, as you say, offer probably the biggest infrastructure opportunity that we've ever seen in our lifetimes.
So it's actually an indication of interest by the sound of you that you're suggesting that we really tackle. Remind us of the scale, if you would, of this Belt and Road behemoth.
Sure. The first thing to say is that I wouldn't call it a project. I would call it a broad ambition around connecting Asia back into Europe along the old ancient silk routes that were around many, many hundreds of years ago. Effectively, it's looking at Southeast Asia, connecting all the way through to China, through the subcontinent and the Caucasus, and into Eastern and Western Europe.
And the opportunities will change, I take it, as it moves through different stages?
Almost certainly, yes. So a lot of the current projects are really focused on strengthening the transport networks and connectivity between the different territories. So if you look at the Mekong area, there's a large amount of rail that's being procured in Laos, Cambodia, Malaysia, Singapore, and Indonesia, all of which will improve connectivity between those different countries. In the same instance, you've got ports and airports being developed across all of those corridors. In places like Pakistan, for example, you've got the China-Pakistan corridor. And so far, you've got around about $46 billion US dollars worth of contracts or investments that have been signed already. And that's split between energy and transport primarily. And then from those, what you would expect to see are economic zones coming forward, manufacturing plants, water plants. There might be extraction projects. So I do think that there is a very long program of investment and development across these corridors, which will lead to many different opportunities.
And is there really not a lot of Australian involvement?
Where Australia has been involved to date is in the advisory capacity, so in law firms and technical consultants. Obviously, Macquarie as a bank is a very globally recognized banking brand that has been involved in infrastructure for many years. But aside from that, the only real big corporate that I've seen investing quite heavily in these emerging markets is Brookfield. And they've taken quite a big exposure in the Indian market.
They're a big infrastructure providing.
Correct. So President Xi Jinping announced the Belt and Road ambition in 2013. His announcements in 2013 precipitated a degree of outbound activity from the Chinese SOEs in places like Pakistan, Bangladesh, Mongolia, parts of Southeast Asia. So their activity in Myanmar has been going on now for a couple of years. So there's a gas pipeline that connects Chaophyu on the northern coast of Myanmar into Kunming. And they are in the process of negotiating a contract for the development of a very big deep sea port in Chaophyu and an industrial park that will effectively allow China access into the Indian Ocean and then direct access to the subcontinent, Middle East and Africa.
What specifically, Mark, would you envisage Australians could be doing?
Well, I think a number of things. If you think about the whole life cycle of an infrastructure project, there's all of the early stage regulatory reform that needs to happen and advisory work that needs to happen in terms of scoping projects. Now, in Australia, you've got a very, very good track record in developing large-scale infrastructure across big geographies, whether it be railroads or highways. And you've got great capability in the form of your architects, your master planners, technical consultants, lawyers, financial advisors, and the rest, all of whom could participate in projects like this. If you then move further down the life cycle of that asset, you've got obviously the investment side of it, so funding, and that is in the form of equity and debt, or you might have lenders that might lend to projects. On the construction side of it, of course, you've got very big construction companies and developers that might be able to go and partner with Chinese SOEs or indeed other builders. And then, of course, there's the operational efficiency around these assets. So how do you make the assets sweat better? How do you make them work more efficiently? And I think that's something that in the emerging markets through which the Belt and Road projects are running, there is very little experience and capacity around those.
I mean, obviously there is some anxiety about partnering with Chinese companies. We've had two very big business people from our shores, James Packer and Kerry Stokes, have basically sold out of China, having devoted, in Kerry Stokes' case, 17 years to getting involved with the Caterpillar franchise. And he basically has taken a very good offer and sold out. He says that he's still very interested, but people are wondering. And I wonder whether you factor this in, that there's a sense of not quite knowing what you're dealing with when you're partnering with Chinese companies.
I think it's a really good point that you make. And if you roll back 5, 6, 10 years and you look at the history of Chinese investment into Africa, you've got some pretty bad horror stories around Chinese developers going in and in exchange for concessions around, say, mineral rights, they might build some infrastructure, which is generally of poor quality, and you saw no real economic benefit to local territories. I think the approach that the Chinese companies are taking now is very different. Firstly, they are far better at what they're doing than they used to be. They've improved their technologies. Their standards are as high as anyone else. So if you look at high-speed rail, for example, their investment into high-speed rail technology has been incredibly high, and they now own and operate over 50% of the global stock of high-speed rail around the world. If you look at some of the other examples around Chinese outbound investment, if you look at the UK market, for example, which historically was dominated by large UK constructors and infrastructure funds, you've got China General Nuclear that's invested over $9 billion for a 33.5% stake in the Hinkley Point power project. And indeed, I've done work recently for North American and European companies that are looking to create longer-term relationships with these companies in order to get access to some of these projects.
Do you not have to use their, as I understand it, they're putting some pretty important restrictions on almost their procurement? You have to use their technology, is it?
Now, one of the ambitions of China, I think, is to make sure that the standards and technologies that they have developed start to become more accepted globally.
So it's a way of raising their own standards too, you're saying?
Absolutely right. I think that is the case.
And so, Mark, I have to say, we're having this conversation amidst rising worry and big time worry about China's debt.
Absolutely. And I don't think that's a uniquely Australian concern. If you look at the last 10 to 15 years of Chinese infrastructure investment, there is a huge amount of money that's been pumped into projects that in some instances might be economically viable and in other instances almost certainly would not be economically viable. And that was a policy that the Chinese government introduced to pump prime, to increase output, to create an infrastructure economy that works. So yes, there is a portion of debt within the Chinese financial sector that is not recoverable.
Well, I just have to ask you about one unviable project that you saw in Myanmar, the highway, please.
Yeah, so it's a remarkable place, Myanmar, and very much at the early stage of development. So you've got some instances where you can see projects being built that might not necessarily provide any economic value. And the one I was referring to is in Naypyidaw. It's the seat of government. So it's a city that's been built effectively to hold all the government and bureaucracy around Myanmar. But they've built a road that goes into Naypyidaw that is 10 lanes each way. So effectively it's a 20-lane road. And there's hardly any cars on it. We went along, we were the only car on the road. And it's a project like that where you sit and think, well, what a waste of money, because that should not have been a priority project. And that money could have been diverted towards electrification grids, water management, power plants.
And I think you actually told my producer, Anne Arnold, that you got out and walked across both sides, saw only a donkey and a rickshaw in the distance.
Absolutely. It was an amazing experience. And you go to something like that and you get a bit dismayed about the waste, really. But then you go to Yangon and you look at the way that Tilawa Economic Zone is being developed, for example. And that is a very, very strong project. So at a bilateral level, the Japanese and Myanmar government signed an agreement to develop this economic zone. So you've got a lot of investment going into that zone, which is necessary and fundamental to the future growth of Myanmar. And I think you can use or find examples of that in most jurisdictions where projects might have been ill-conceived and it might have been because of some sort of political pressure or a vested interest somewhere that no one really understands. But there are examples like that everywhere.
All right. Sally Forth, even though we don't know everything and can't dot I's and cross T's, thanks so much indeed for joining us, Mark Rathbone.
Geraldine, thank you very much indeed for your time.
And Mark is a partner at PwC Singapore, leader of their capital projects and infrastructure in Asia Pacific.